Now, China's always in our news, but I wonder how much we really know about its culture and its politics. Modern China is a bundle of contradictions, really. Its image is modern and slick and luxurious and prosperous, but it's also, as we know, a one-party state where people can pay a terrible price for speaking out. Nicholas Jost is a novelist, he's an essayist, he's a professor at Adelaide Uni, and he's the general editor of that massive anthology of Australian literature published by Macquarie. And he's got a long association with China. He's written about it in his fiction and his essays. And he's really one of those people who's helped the rest of us understand what's going on in contemporary China. His latest book is lovely. It's a collection of short stories called Bapo, I think that's how you say it, and it's stories that are all influenced by China in some way. He's also been reading a new novel, which is called Death Fugue, which is by the Chinese writer Xing Curie, who writes about the Tiananmen Square massacre in a very bold way. And Nicholas joins us now from our Adelaide studios. Good morning, Professor.
Hello, Michael.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Now, I think I first met you. I've been casting my mind back, and I think I first met you at ANU in 1980 or 81. And you were already sort of getting involved in Chinese matters then, weren't you?
Yeah, I was learning Chinese at the Canberra College of Advanced Education, as it then was, at a night school, for mysterious reasons. But somehow something in my bones told me that China was going to be important to Australia, and I wanted to look into that. And so I learned a bit of Chinese, and then my first visit to China was in 1983.
I can remember you doing this and thinking, this is just impossible, because Chinese, it just must be impossible to learn. I think if you were a small child, I could understand learning it. But it must have been an incredible challenge, because you were a mature person by then.
Yeah, people always say how hard Chinese is to learn. It's actually not so hard to learn how to speak Chinese. The writing is very hard. And if you're a Chinese child and you're just forced to do it through repetition, that's probably a very good way to learn it. My writing isn't great. It is the writing of a kindergarten child in Chinese. But I learned how to communicate in the language, and that was really essential for the period when I worked there in the late 1980s.
So you were a cultural counsellor. What does that mean?
Yeah. Well, I started out teaching, actually. I taught there for 2 years, and then I became the cultural counsellor at the Australian Embassy, a very august title, like the title of those courtiers in the in the emperor's
oh, yes. I'd like
domain.
I'd like you to meet Nicholas Jost. He's our cultural counsellor. Oh, gosh.
But in those days in the Australian Embassy, it really covered everything that wasn't directly politics or trade. So that included the arts, of course, but it also included education and sport and animal exchanges and generally people-to-people exchanges, right, which is what I was very interested in.
I like the idea of you kicking a footy around in Tiananmen Square. I can see that, Nicholas.
I umpired a cricket match.
Is that right?
Do you know?
Well, I'm so sorry. We'll press on. So let's talk about this book. This is a lovely book, isn't it? It just looks gorgeous. It's got the most fantastic cover. So this word that's on the cover, bapo, what's that?
Yeah, it's a Chinese artistic term. I mean, the first half of it, ba, is the Chinese word for eight, which is a lucky number in Chinese. The second half, po, means broken or worn out, and it kind of suggests that the luck has run out. So it's a word of opposites, and in a way, after your luck runs out, if you can still survive, that's another kind of luck. So it suggests sort of the wheel of fortune. In Chinese artistic terms, what happens is that artists paint what looks like a collage of broken or burnt bits and pieces and turn it into something rather beautiful. And in a way, that's what I've tried to do with the book, by taking these short stories, these sketches, these different angles on China, and putting them into a pattern that doesn't tell the whole story, but maybe it has some openings into it.
It'd be good if you'd stop whacking that microphone there in Adelaide, Nick. We're all hearing you do that. So it's an art form where it looks like a collage. It looks like a lot of stuff stuck onto the surface, but it's all been painted.
It's an illusion by the artist. And so for me as a writer, that became a kind of an image for what I'm doing in these stories, where I'm staging or creating illusions of different scenes in China, or else transferring some of those aesthetic ideas into writing that's set in Australia.
We're talking to Nicholas Jost this morning, who is, he's a man who knows lots about China and a wonderful writer. And we're talking about his collection of short stories, which is called Bapo. And one of the stories that really caught my eye and that I enjoyed very much when I was reading the book last night is called Donkey Feast, which is about a group of friends who gather some years after their original gathering, and they've got a photograph that recalls the old days. Just tell us what's going on in this story.
Well, those old days were back in the 1980s, around the time of Tiananmen Square, when I was also in China. And these people have been involved with the arts. And over the intervening 25 years, their lives have changed incredibly as China has changed. And some have had incredible success. Others have disappeared. Some have changed their names and gone on to other lives. And so they meet up to reflect on what has happened to them in the intervening years. And for me, this is something that happens a lot when I'm in China, because in that time, Australia has also changed. I've changed. Some of these Chinese artists have come to Australia, and their lives have changed. It was interesting when you were talking about pop before. I mean, some of these artists were part of the Chinese pop movement that came to Australia in the exhibition Mao Goes Pop in the early 1990s. So they're gathering to reflect on what it means and what the losses over this period have been, as well as the gains. It's called Donkey Feast because they're taken by a very successful artist to a restaurant outside Beijing where they eat donkey meat. And the reason they're eating donkey meat is that all the other food they might eat is now just too dangerous to eat.
Everything else is considered toxic. Yes, everything else is off for some reason. So donkey meat is the food of choice. I can't imagine eating donkey. You explain that it has enormous bones.
Yes, and they give you plastic gloves to wear while you hold the kind of donkey shank and gnaw on it, you know, if that's what you want to do. But in fact, in this story, the very successful artist has now given up meat altogether.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
And is on a strict diet.
I like to think of myself as an enthusiastic multiculturalist, but I'm drawing the line at donkey meat. I'm sorry, but I'm not even going to try donkey meat. Now, what other story could we talk about? I do love the one about the academics who are on the tour. Well, there includes academics who are on a tour. You've sort of captured the characters of the various people extremely well. But let's talk just very briefly about Loving China, which is about an Australian couple who share a love of China. Why is this one significant to you?
Well, China becomes a big part of your life when you get involved with it. And it becomes almost like a partner in a relationship if you have a relationship with someone, as I do, particularly if they're also involved with China. So China is ever present, but it's quite hard to share that with the wider world. And for me, it's a bit of a story about how in Australia we have all of these connections with China through all sorts of people, but we still don't really understand. We find it hard to understand, and we put up various barriers in the way. Now, I'm not saying China is easy to understand, but it's kind of wasteful and even dangerous, I think, for the country when we can't use the expertise for understanding China that we actually have all around us.
Yeah, it's mad. It's absolutely mad. I mean, not just China, but, Indonesia. You know, we live next door to Indonesia and we know so little about Indonesia. And all we ever discuss is political conflict with Indonesia. You know, the cultural stuff is just not explored at all. Mm. Do you think it's changing, Nicholas? I mean, you know, I laughed about you learning Chinese back in the 1980s because it seemed so unfathomable to me. But when I meet young people today, it does seem that there are lots of kids who are learning Chinese at school.
Yeah, there are. But I think there's now a kind of tendency to think, well, the Chinese all speak such good English. Let's leave it to them to do the interpreting of all of this. That is one of the problems. I think also in some ways China's becoming harder to understand as it becomes more powerful. China is very interested in itself now. It's actually less interested in sort of learning from the West. When I was the cultural counsellor back in the 1980s, we always got a very warm welcome and a great sort of participation in any sorts of cultural exchanges we did in Australia. That's not really the case now. People are not that interested. And so I think that also makes it harder to have a real flow of exchange.
Let's talk about this book you've been reading. So this is a book called Death Fugue. It's by a Chinese writer called Sheng Qiri, and it's just been published in Australia by Girimondo. So who is she?
Yeah, well, she's an absolutely remarkable Chinese writer in her 40s, and this is an extraordinary and important book. The reason why is that there's been almost no writing about Tiananmen in 1989 in Chinese. As we all know, the discussion of the topic is completely forbidden. And what that means is there's been quite a lot of writing from outside China and a lot of it in English, but it hasn't been possible for writers inside China to really go there. And the pressure has built up over the years. And now she has come out with this extraordinary novel, which uses satire and fantasy in an indirect way to talk about these things, not only what happened back then, but what the kind of repercussions have been over the years since.
Now, we've only got a couple of minutes, Nick, but so she's describing a sort of future society called Swan Valley, which I guess can be read as China in the future, and pregnancies that are deemed likely to produce children with low IQs are terminated immediately. It's this sort of world, is it?
It's a contrast between a humanistic China that was crushed in 1989 and a China of wealth and power and total control that might be now. But her image for Tiananmen is this giant pile of excrement that suddenly appears in the square in the centre of the city one day and provokes all sorts of concerns about the stink, and then it ends in kind of violence and disappearance. And then we return to this bright, shiny, luxurious new world. It's written in an incredible kind of filigreed but quite rough style. And for a Western reader, it's part of what I was saying earlier. It's a challenge to go there. It's a novel like nothing else, but it is an expression that's coming right from the heart of China. So for that reason, I think it's an important book.
It sounds a little bit like Brave New World, is it?
It has elements of Brave New World. It has elements of Viennese writing at the beginning of the 20th century. It has elements of Philip K. Dick science fiction, but it's also very feminist and very, very seductive. It's about seduction of different kinds, of the state through its propaganda, of noble ideals for democracy and change, and between people, men and women, in their interrelationships.
So it sounds as though you're recommending this one, Nick.
It's a pretty interesting book.
Yeah, all right. Well, that sounds tremendous. And that's called Death Fugue. And it's by, what's her name again?
Sheng Qiri.
Sheng Qiri, which is spelled K-E-Y-E. It's just been published in English. And also, I'm happy to recommend your book, Nicholas. It's called Bapo, and it's published by Girimondo as well. Thank you for coming into the studio. It's been good to talk to you.
Cheers, Michael. Thank you.
Nicholas Jose. And these days, Nick is a professor of English and creative writing at the University of Adelaide.